You're listening to Juno Afternoon. I'm Shelley Delaney. On Monday, the University of Alaska Southeast Alaska Coastal Rainforest Center released a Juno-specific climate report. Here with me now is Jim Powell, project coordinator and lead editor for this report. Hi, Jim.
Hi. Thanks for inviting me.
Oh, thanks for being here today. There's so much to talk about with this report, but let's start with introductions. Would you please introduce yourself and maybe tell us a little bit about who you are and how you came to be in this role?
Sure. My name's Jim Powell, and I'm an assistant research professor at UAS. More specifically, I work at the Alaska Coastal Rainforest Center at UAS. And that's kind of like a small think tank for researchers, that we do research locally in Southeast, sometimes even in the Arctic and other parts of Alaska. I'm what's called an interdisciplinary professor in the sense that I do social research as well as I used to work in water quality and at DEC, so I have this science background as well as policy background. I was on the assembly for 9 years, and so I have this policy and kind of a mixture, kind of a broad background. So that's who I am.
Excellent. Well, thanks for being here today. I'm excited to ask you some questions about this report, but I thought maybe we'd just start with an overview for folks who haven't seen it yet, don't know what it is, didn't know it was coming. How did it come to be, and who were some of the contributors, and how long has this been in the works?
Sure, yeah. Well, there's quite a history to this. In 2007, the mayor at the time, former mayor Bruce Botello, and the dean at the university, Brendan Kelly, said, you know, we've got to start thinking about this climate change here. And that was in 2007. And then they said, well, let's put together a report. And that's what Bruce wanted. So he went to the university. He said, get your best and brightest, put them together, and put together a report on the impacts of climate change in Juneau. That was hard to do because you have these global models, but you have to downscale those. And that's a lot of work, that's a lot of computation, and we don't have a lot of track record information. Alaska generally doesn't have a lot of information. So the scientists, you know, since 1940s, you know, we've got information about precipitation at the airport, but, you know, we're still creating a lot of information. So back then, that was a new report. That was almost unique that a small community, that a local community would downscale some of that information. So that was cool. Mm-hmm. So we got it out, we put together people together, and then 15 years later, here we are. So we've learned a lot. And I thought it was important to do it again. And I was a co-author of that report back then. And so I thought, well, let's revise this. So what I did was I looked at the report. It was largely a white paper in the sense that there were some graphs, but it wasn't really easy to look at. So that was one of my targets. So I got Molly from our staff to help me, you know, format. I said, I want this thing for people to pick up.
Molly Tankersley?
Yes, she's great. And what she did was help me kind of put it together. So our targets for this were, and I think we're hitting the target so far, is that it's for the general public. So we had to keep it, you know, in good, I don't want to say simple language, but not highly technical language.
Yeah.
And yet we still wanted information for scientists to reference, because there's a lot of the pages in the back are references, and then decision makers. So how do you do that? So we put the history in the front, and then we created 9 key messages. 7 of those messages are ecological, they're science-based, and 2 of them really go to policy and what is Juno doing? And I thought that would be a key message, because it is a key message. Back in 2007, we weren't doing a lot. Now we're doing a lot for a small community. We have NGOs. We have 3 NGOs that are working on climate change. And more than that, I mean, almost every agency, every organization thinks about climate change. But specifically, there's 3 NGOs in town that do that. So we have 9 key messages. We have the ecological stuff that was in the old report and is updated in this one. And then into the report, we have adaptation and mitigation. What are we doing? So there's really 3 sections of the report, and that wasn't in the old report. So I think that's an improvement, and I think it looks really good. I'm really happy with the layout and that it's really pleasing. It's something you'd pick up and want to read.
Absolutely. I definitely have some questions about the images. But just in the first few pages, there's a message from Ray Paddock, who represents the Central Council of Tlingit and Haida Indian Tribes of Alaska, and it it's sort of a response, or it talks about their climate change adaptation plan as a response to changes that they've seen on their land and with their food and their resources. So how does this report support their efforts, or how are you guys working with Central Council in your research efforts?
One of the first things I did was call Ray, and I've been working with him on other projects. And I said, hey, we want to do this climate change report. He says, well, we just came out with one. Mm-hmm. You know, it's adaptation report. I said, great. I said, do we want to, put it together as one report? And we said, no, because theirs really is based upon traditional and ecological knowledge as well as scientific knowledge. So their basis of their assumptions and everything are very different. And it was a regional report, because it's for Tlingit Haida. So we thought, well, let's highlight it at the beginning of the report so people know it's there and can go directly to it. So that was what the thinking was.
Well, I love that you did that. And there's quite a bit as well of, I saw there's some Tlingit language in the report as well. Some place names were used, and that was, I was pleased to see that.
Well, it was a thought, but actually because there's 23 authors, and that's the challenge to get it out. It took almost 2 years to put this together because
I can only imagine all that went into it.
Yeah, it was a labor of love, I think you'd call it. The authors really brought a lot of different perspectives. And one author, Richard Carsten, he said, make sure you put as much, native language as can. I thought, oh, okay, I can. We could have done a lot more. I wish I could have done a lot more, but in our time limitations, that's the best we could do, but we tried.
Well, I'm sure you'll have the opportunity to update this report or put out another one here in the next couple of years, but let's stick with this one because it's awesome. As you mentioned, it outlines 9 major takeaways. I know they are all of high importance, but are there a couple that are of immediate concern that you might want to talk about today?
I was listening to your last interview because one of the authors is Aaron, and you were asking you are very good at this. Oh. You were asking some very pointed questions. I think one of the newer ones here, landslides, because it's visible, it's new, and it's something maybe we can control, or not control, but to manage. There's going to be flashy floods. We're going to have more precip, as we know, warmer temperatures, which all drive this. But I think that's an important one, an important message. And people know about it. They can see it. In local government, where I used to work for 9 years on the assembly, local government, as I said in another interview, I said that local government is really important right now because it's not polarized. It's by design nonpartisan. So we get things done. We have to. It's very accountable. And that's one of the things you see. So I think that you'll see some things in that area, and we have a section in this report on that. So I think that was really important. All of them are really important to monitor and to watch and see how things play out. We can't really, if you pick one, it's hard to do because it's so ubiquitous. There are going to be surprises, which we don't know. If you ask scientists, they'll say, well, we have some indicators. We have some trend information. But to tell you exactly what's going to happen in the future, we can't do that. But we have some good trend information that we can try to work on right now.
Well, how well equipped do you think we are to keep people safe from landslides right now? What's been done and what needs to be done?
That's a very hard thing to... I think there's a lot that's been done. We have mass wasting zones, and now... In the report, it talks to this. And if you're really interested, please go to the report and read the section because it's well written by Katie.
We're going to try to drive people to the report, but yeah. You can give us some teasers now.
Well, I think we're doing a lot. I know that they're planning more. I mean, you have to do more engineering. You have to do more planning and thinking about it. It brings back, I can't not talk about this. And when I was on the assembly in the 90s and 2000s, we had similar concerns about those zones. They weren't as dramatic as now, but we had concerns about, well, do we put it on maps, and mm-hmm. then it gets into private property and all these other complicated issues. So we have that. There's a policy issue, but then there's the science issue. And we can speak to the science, and we can start building that up more and more and more as we know more. So I think that's going to help inform those policy decisions that have to be made at the City Hall. So I think that this helps. And this report, again, is just built upon, we say, built upon the shoulders of others. And that's what's really important about the report. It's a moment in time. It's what we know right now, and we're building upon that, and maybe we can make better decisions. So my hope is that the City Assembly will use the report, the information in it, to be better informed, to make better decisions. And that's a key issue that needs to be responded to in Juneau now, and in Southeast, as we saw in Haines and Sitka. Very important.
Putting landslide zones on maps.
Right, and doing the hard work. People, it's hard because we always want the answer, but we need to go back and figure out, okay, the particulars about it, the science. To get to the answer, we have to slow down, back up, look at the science, and then make the decision.
Well, in addition to landslides, floods are another threat to life and property. Can you talk a little bit about the status of storm drains in CBJ?
I wish I could. Tomorrow night, or tomorrow at 9 o'clock, we'll talk more about that.
Okay.
But I think that what I've heard so far, I'm not an expert in that area, but I think that, you know, the community was engineered with the best knowledge we had for what size of a culvert do you have. And it was based upon science then. We have to redesign that, and we have to think about the engineering that was done, and now what is the new engineering, rather than 100-year flood zones and events. Those events are occurring more often. So it's important to look at that data right now and go, maybe we should be redesigning things around. And I think that comes. And that's engineering, not science. But I think that it's time to look at the engineering based upon the new science.
And the new science is saying that these 100-year events, these 20-year events are going to be
occurring more often
and be bigger.
Could be flashier, you know, more events.
Yeah. And you are referencing a webinar that's happening tomorrow at 9 a.m.
Yes.
And that will feature many of the authors from this report.
Yes, I think we have, we're gathering as we go, because actually it conflicts with field seasons right now.
But of course.
I think we've got 5 or 6 other authors.
Yeah,
so
including
my
last guest, Aaron Jacobs.
Yeah, exactly.
There. Excellent.
Exactly.
Everyone will get their chance to interview him, and you as well. Well, this time of year, I want to shift again. There's so much talk about the impact of cruise ships, and this report states that they are, in fact, a major source of air pollution, but that dock electrification may be a solution to that. So how far is there to go based on your research?
Yeah, that's an interesting, that's a very interesting topic. It's one that I've been doing research on. In fact, I have a National Science Foundation grant to compare Juneau with 4 other places in the Arctic that are cruise locations. And that's one issue. For example, in Bjørgen, Norway, which I just got back from 3 weeks ago, they're going in some of their fjords, no emissions at all. Zones.
Wow.
Zero. That's something. That's really something.
Yeah.
In Juneau, we've moved forward, you know, we had the first plug-in ship in the world, which we can be very proud
of. It's very cool.
It's very, very cool. So I think it was last Friday that I was with a group, Kirby Day and others from the city and some assembly members. We looked at we actually saw them plug in, I should say. And we talked about the future. And I know that some of the things discussed were where are we going to do it next? Because some of I think the big thing that needs to be now is that the visitor industry working group, which came out with recommendations 2 years ago, before COVID hit, and they had a lot of good recommendations. I thought it was very, very good recommendations. One was there was a limitation on the number of cruise ships, and that's what we put in here, to turn up the volume on those recommendations, really.
Yeah.
We referenced those because we thought they were good. So one was to limit the number of cruise ships. The other one was to have all plug-in, you know, docks. So I know that in the plans, or somewhere in the plans right now, the city docks, there would be 2 more plug-ins. Very expensive. You do anything on the dock, it is not just hundreds of thousands, it's millions of dollars because it's very stout and it's very big and very expensive. So I know that that is in the works for another two, and eventually we'll have them all plugged in. And I know that ships themselves are going to different fuels, and the International Maritime Organization, the IMO, which is the international governing body, if you can say governing, has recommended different fuels, and they have goals too. So it's not just us in Juneau. There is an international perspective and directive of cruise ships, which is only 2% of the ships that are out there. It's a small percentage, but it's a percentage to change your fuels that are better and actually go towards lower impact, because one ship has a heck of a lot of pollutants compared to what we do in a car. Mm-hmm. So let's look at that. There's another thing about climate change that we need to consider when we're looking at a climate change report. What are our bounds? Do we want to talk about cruise ships? They're here and they go. Are they beyond our bounds? I don't think they are. I think that we use them, we benefit from them, they're part of our community. So they should be part of the calculus when we do our greenhouse gas emissions. What about the mines that we have? I mean, they're part of our community, so they should be part of that calculus of what's our greenhouse gas number for a community. So that all needs to be considered. That's why that was in a report, and the emissions is big enough to be considered, and it's something we can do something about as a city.
So much more to talk about, Jim. I could honestly keep you here for another 20 minutes. We need to wrap up, though. So the last thing I wanted to ask you about were the images in the report, because they, as you mentioned, like the layout, the design, it's so readable. The images are as important as the text. There's graphs, there's photos, and there's even like computer-generated images of the future. So do you want to talk a little bit about how the imagery supports the report?
Well, it was a balance. I mean, it was really difficult to ask a scientist, can you tell me about your research in a paragraph and make sure it doesn't use too many references and technical information? That was hard. But I have to give a lot of credit to Molly Tankersley, because she really did a great job of putting it together. And that was the point, is that pictures tell 1,000 words, and we didn't want to crowd it too much like a like reports that I read, and that I produce in articles, because people won't pick it up. And especially the 9 messages, I thought was important. As a former assembly member, I want to know what the message is. So I think that was important. I think the graphics are really, really good. You can look at just the graphics and get a heck of a story.
It's true. They all seem like, I mean, there's nothing extraneous there. Every image has a meaning and belongs there. It's not just there for decoration.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. They all are referenced in the text. They all mean something, for sure.
Well, the report is. I don't mean to interrupt you or cut you off. We are almost out of time, but the report is quite magnificent. It's a work of art. I can tell it is a labor of love, as you said. I know there's a lot of work going into it. I do encourage everyone to check it out. It's very informative and very well done.
Yeah, and I should thank the 22 other authors. They did a great job in hanging in there through the 2 years and back and forth and everything else that happens in a production like this.
Oh my goodness, I've been a part of a few much smaller scale things that took so much work and time and consensus, and it is not easy. So hat tip to all of you. I know how much work that was, and I encourage everyone to check out the website, the webinar tomorrow. Where can we find out information about that?
9 a.m. and it is on the website, the UAS. It's called the Alaska Coastal Rainforest Center.
Okay, I'm sure folks can find it, and if they can't, they can
contact
check
me.
Us, Juno Afternoon's website as well. It's been a delight to meet you and talk with you today,
too.
Jim. Thanks so much for being here.
Thanks.